Google that up. Lickety Split. KSCO Global. Find the channel. Find the live video right there. Boom. It's 2:06. We'll get a very quick look at your traffic. Well, computer is frozen. Let's skip traffic. It's time for Planet Watch on KSCO Santa Cruz.
Big solutions to Earth-sized problems. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman.
I'm Joe Jordan.
Today on the program, Paul Hawkins' new book, Drawdown, outlines 100 ways to tackle global warming. We'll talk to his chief researcher about why the best-selling author chose to highlight some unexpected ways to tackle this issue. We'll also talk with Hawkins' lead researcher, Catherine Wilkinson, about the how, the why, and the what of this groundbreaking new project, and learn what we can do as individuals and collectively to shape our future and the future of the planet. And I might add that this book and the concept is not entirely without controversy. Some people think that it relies too much on high technology and not enough about simplifying our lifestyles. So we'll find out more as the interview progresses in just a moment. So we have science notes and phenomenon. And if you'd like to get in touch with us and interact with our guest, you can email us at radioplanetwatch@gmail.com. We are also streaming live on Facebook and possibly on YouTube. So if you go to Planet Watch Radio on Facebook, you will not only hear us, but you can see us. One of the pleasures of teaching journalism at the community college is I get to teach young journalists how to do things. And in this case, Caroline King, one of our interns, has this story. She interviewed one of the first guests we ever had on Planet Watch, Professor Gary Griggs, about a new study that came out in California indicating that the sea levels may possibly rise a lot faster and bigger than was previously thought. So here's an interview about that story. We'll have that story for you in just a moment after we fix. After we fix our technical issues, we'll go to the other news stories. But for some reason, my iTunes is just not playing.
Gary Griggs was actually our very first guest on this program back on January 15th of 2017. That's the one interview that I don't think is on the regular archive, but you should check it out and get a hold of us. And by the way, we should tell this early and often. You can get a hold of us live on this show at radioplanetwatch@gmail.com.
Let's give it one more try.
In the next 7 years, this classic California summer scene could change drastically. A report by the state of California estimates sea levels to rise. Years. Gary Griggs, professor of marine sciences from UCSC, explains why we should expect waters to rise 30 to 40 times faster than in the past. The recent fluctuation in sea level rise is caused by two main factors.
The ocean is getting warmer, and so as water warms, it expands, and the balance between ice and ocean is changing.
Glaciers around the world, such as Alaska, the Alps, the Andes, the Himalayas, and Patagonia, are all experiencing warming.
The warmer it gets, the more ice melts, the higher sea level rises.
The polar ice caps in Greenland contain a large reservoir of ice, and if melted, around 190 feet of potential sea level rise.
It's sort of like pulling the cork out of the bottle, and the question is, how fast does that happen and when?
Since the 1850s, 12 tide gauges along the coast of California have monitored changes in sea level. In 1993, satellites were launched to get more accurate readings of the ocean. In the last 20 or so years, the rise of water has almost doubled, from 7 inches per 100 years to 13 inches per 100 years. Projections for further increase in the report are based on how much fossil fuels we are expected to burn. The burning of fossil fuels such as coal, oil, and gas release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Those molecules basically act like this blanket that doesn't let the heat out or doesn't let very much of it out. Here's carbon dioxide content going up, and here's global temperature going up. Here's sea level going up on the same scale.
As of 2016, there were 408 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the air.
About 45% goes into the atmosphere, 25% is taken up by vegetation, 30% goes into the ocean.
Once these greenhouse gases have affected the planet, there is no way to undo it.
There's some big prices to pay for things we do now that are going to have an impact. Even if we stopped everything tomorrow, you can't stop it completely, but we can slow it down.
Global sea level rise is the most obvious manifestation of climate change. It is an issue that will have far-reaching consequences for California, given its 1,100-mile open coastline. Sea level rise will continue to threaten coastal communities and infrastructure through more frequent flooding and continued erosion.
8 of the megacities on the planet, which means over 10 million people, are basically built on shorelines. And there's now about 150 million people living within 3 feet of high tide. California is sort of this trend center in a lot of ways, and I think other states, even other countries, look to see, whoa, what's California going to do? We'll do that.
The updated report intends to provide guidance to state agencies for incorporating sea level rise projections into planning, design, permitting, construction, investment, and other decisions.
States can do a lot, and California's done a lot. At the federal level, it's just more difficult. So we want to make sure the policy piece, which isn't something scientists should be making up any more than any other profession, but that we're giving them all the information, Santa Cruz and Capitol and Half Moon Bay and San Francisco and San Diego, have to come up with a plan, how they're going to deal with it.
The seventh key finding highlighted in the report states that waiting for scientific certainty is neither a safe, viable, nor economical option.
There has to be some compromises. People say you can't have environment and employment. You know, we have the strongest environmental regulations and we're the sixth biggest economy in the world. We're showing, no, that's not true. The concluding is it's real, it's bad, it's us, scientists agree, and there's hope.
For Planet Watch Radio, I'm Caroline King.
And thanks to Caroline for that story. Up next, another ocean story from Cade Pastelnik.
And this study was retrieved from University of California, Irvine. Recent research suggests that the temperature increase of 0.5 degrees Celsius over the past 50 years has placed the low and mid-latitude countries at a greater risk of deadly heat waves. Data retrieved from the India Meteorological Department highlights that the chance of a heat wave killing more than 100 people has increased from 13% to 32%. In 1975, only 43 Indian citizens died from heat wave-related causes, while in 1998, that number jumped to around 1,600. This paints a bleak future since temperatures in that region are produced to increase 2.2 to 5.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. More than one quarter of India's 1.3 billion population live in poverty and earn just $1.25 a day. Few of those impoverished have access to electricity and even basic air conditioning. Though the United States' recent exit of the Paris Climate Agreement has made an international coalition more complicated, these eye-opening numbers could be a warning for the wealthier countries to take global warming even more seriously.
Thank you for that, Cade. And coming up next, we have another story, but I'm going to first tell you about something that are not Russian operatives. They're called perovskites, and they just might disrupt, perhaps, as much as those other Russian operatives, in a positive way, how we get solar energy through our windows. A Korean research team has developed a semi-transparent perovskite solar cell that could be great candidates for solar windows. So imagine the sun coming into your house and actually making energy through the windows. Scientists are exploring ways to develop transparent or semi-transparent solar cells as a substitute for glass walls in modern buildings. Those giant skyscrapers could be generating energy for us, harnessing solar energy. So look for that. That's a Korean team. They include Seon Gap-yu and another person who is called Professor Nam-gyu Park. Those are the two authors of that study. Look for more of that in the future.
And I just have to interject here. Perovskites are like one of my favorite things. I've been telling folks about this for a dozen years, and they have two main great hopes for us. I mean, I'm sure there are going to be problems. We have to figure out how to finesse them. But one of them is, yeah, vast new source of efficient and possibly quite economical solar energy. The other thing, which was not mentioned in Rachel's story there, is that there are ways to use them to sequester vast amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere. So, you know, stay tuned for more. But, our occasional contributor and great friend who's now sitting on the couch in the studio with us, Michael McKay, thanks to him for his contributions. He was telling me on the way over here that, well, we got to get the lead out. Apparently, perovskites have a bunch of lead in them. I don't know what the chemical formula is for perovskites. It'd be fun to look up. But anyway, let's figure it out. Okay, thanks.
All right, I've got another ocean story for us today. Nations responsible for much of the world's ocean pollution have pledged to start cleaning up their act. Delegates from China, Thailand, Indonesia, and the Philippines said they would work to keep plastics out of the seas at the first ever UN Ocean Summit. All 193 members of the United Nations also unanimously agreed to measures that will begin to reverse the declining ocean health. By the end of the conference, more than 1,300 voluntary commitments had been made in order to tackle issues like marine pollution, illegal and overfishing, ocean acidification, and lack of high seas governance. While UN officials praise the statement, some environmentalists say the measures don't go nearly far enough.
All right, thank you for that. That was Tommy Martin, our intern here on Planet Watch, along with Kate Pastelnik. Now, we're very excited to bring on the line Catherine Wilkinson. She is the senior writer at Project Drawdown. She's been working to bring Drawdown to life. Drawdown is Paul Hawkins' new book of 100 ways to tackle climate change and carbon emissions. She brings with her an interdisciplinary background that cuts across sustainability, strategy, and thought leadership. Previously, Catherine was director of strategy at the purpose consultancy Bright House. She also taught at the University of Oxford and worked on the National Resources Defense Council, among other major environmental organizations. And we're very happy to have her with us right here on Planet Watch. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks so much. It's my pleasure.
Great to have you. And in the studio, we have Joe Jordan, my co-host, and he's been reading all about Project Drawdown. So I thought we'd start with a question. What inspired Paul Hawken to write this book, and what's the context of which all of this comes about?
Sure. Well, I think as so many projects do, they sort of live inside of the mind of the creator for many, many years. Paul found himself sort of persistently nagged by these questions that in the face of this incredible body of science about what is happening to our planet and what will happen if climate change remains unchecked, he had this question of, but are we really clear on what we, meaning all of humanity, can do to address it? And the answer really had been no, not really. Paul found himself in conversation with various environmental groups saying, you know, do we have a list? Do we have sort of a comprehensive apples-to-apples perspective on the solutions we have, technologies, practices that are already proven, and how much they could each move the needle, say, between now and mid-century? And conversation after conversation, people said, yeah, that would be so helpful. We don't have the capacity or the knowledge, et cetera, to do that. And Paul being Paul, at some point, he felt like we really needed these answers, particularly around 2012, 2013, when folks were, longtime climate activists sort of looking at the scenario at hand and saying it might be game over. And really Project Drawdown was started to say, okay, before we accept impossible, let's actually do the math to understand what is indeed possible.
So, Catherine, I got a couple questions for you. One's sure. Just a simple little thing. First of all, where are you right now? You're not in the studio with us. I'm just trying to visualize. Catherine, where are you?
I'm not in the studio. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
Whoa! How's the weather back there? They're probably hot, I think.
It's hot. It's mid-80s and a little humid.
Okay.
Good swimming weather.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, by the way, we had the webcam on here. Maybe if Jason's tuned in here to our show, our engineer, he could switch it back to the scene out over the beach. I was noticing, here's a weather report for everybody in the country. In Santa Cruz, California today, it is very windy. The webcam was bouncing around. You might also even get sick if you watch it too long. But anyway, so my main question for you is, okay, there was a whole spate of books out, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 things you can do to save the world, blah, blah, blah. And so, okay, first of all, what's the difference between this thing and all those?
I appreciate that question. So it's interesting. Before this book came out, if you had, typed into Google search, top 10 solutions to global warming, you would get some different lists, many of which have some value, but are kind of chock full of proverbs, if you will. Live closer to work. Drive less, eat less meat, these sorts of things. And oftentimes you have, something like using power strips in your home sitting next to something like electric vehicles or rooftop solar, right? With not a lot of data to go on in terms of, well, how do we compare these things? And how much impact can each of them actually deliver? So what's really unique about this project is the research that sits behind it. So we have a team of 60 plus research fellows who have worked on Drawdown over the past few years, who have taken the incredible bodies of data and peer-reviewed research that already exist in the world to explore, okay, technology X, let's say rooftop solar panels, if this technology is scaled vigorously but plausibly between now and 2050, actually how many gigatons of carbon dioxide or equivalent emissions can be reduced?
Hang on. Sure. I got to stop you right there. Gigatons. Most people do not know what a gigaton is. It's a billion tons, which is, by the way, 1,000 million. And most people have no clue even what a million is, let alone 1,000 of those. It would take you basically a lifetime to count to 1 billion. So that's a gigaton. Okay.
Thank you. Context.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So actually looking at the emissions impact for each of the solutions is one piece, but the analysis actually goes further to look at, A, what's the net cost to implement the solution? So kind of compared to business as usual, right? So what's the cost to purchase an electric vehicle as opposed to a gasoline car? And then also, what are the operational savings over 30 years? So, for example, a business that is using telepresence as opposed to sending its employees on airplanes, how much money can they save over that time?
Right.
So it's a combination of those things, yeah.
So I wanted to delve into the list, which is quite long. We don't have time to go over all 100 items, but just taking the top 10 is interesting because you have them grouped into different sectors. You have materials, energy, food, land use, women and girls. And I was surprised to see in the top 10, educating girls and family planning. You don't usually see those in lists of high-tech solutions. This isn't a high-tech thing at all because we can educate people now without, lots of technology and scientists getting involved. We just need schools, and family planning is something we funded traditionally as a country around the world. That's under dispute right now. But tell me about those two, since those are number 6 and 7, and collectively they add up to quite a bit of reduction, something like 60 gigatons each, if that's correct.
That's right. Yep, that's exactly right. So there is a section of the book called Women and Girls, and educating girls and family planning are two of the three solutions in that section. The other one focuses on women, smallholder farmers. And really kind of the core of the thinking behind this sector is simply this, that advancing women's rights, opportunities, and well-being ends up having positive ripple effects for society and the planet. So in the case of educating girls and family planning, we're talking about closing the gap on access to education or access to contraception and family planning. So there are millions of girls around the world who are not in classrooms today, and that's a particular problem at sort of the level of secondary education. And it matters for a whole host of reasons around, you know, kind of well-being and community and economic development. It matters for public health, just many, many positive ripple effects of education. But one of them also happens to be that women who have more years of school choose to have fewer children, and those children are healthier. So they more actively engage in family planning. And of course, family planning is the technology, if you will, that actually makes it possible to, you know, have some influence over the number and the spacing of the children that you have. So the impact that you see with these two, each just a touch under 60 gigatons, has to do with basically fewer feet making their carbon footprints on the planet by 2050. So actually when you add the two of those together, empowering women and girls is actually the number one solution to global warming.
Right. So let's talk about it a little longer, because some people would say, yeah, but if the United States, which has already reduced, you know, some of its population growth, a person in this country uses more carbon than someone in India, for example, because of our developed state and the fact that we're very consumption heavy. So it's not an easy equation. How do you, I mean, now I'm talking about population, not family planning, and I'm making the jump because it seems like environmentalists just have trouble talking about population anymore, but I'm going to talk about it. So how do you calculate the gigatons based on family planning if you're not going to use the word population? And second, if they're not all using the same amount, doesn't it matter which country you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And I think part of the challenge historically around talking about population is talking about population in the absence of all of the other things we need to address, right? So these are two of 80 solutions that are modeled and reported in this book. Clearly, much of the work, the vast majority of the work that needs to be done around global warming solutions is in countries where, as you've said, population is steady or in some cases declining. And those are the places in the world, again, as you said, Rachel, where per capita emissions are so high. Nonetheless, no matter where you live in the world, there is some amount of per capita emissions. So what's looked at here, the rest of our models assume the UN's medium population projection for 2050. Its high population projection is just over a billion, about 1.1 billion, I think, people more. So what we've looked at here is the impact of addressing those gaps in access to education and family planning, and what that translates into for hitting a medium population projection as opposed to a high population projection.
That makes a lot of sense. If you're just joining us, we are Planet Watch Radio. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman with Joe Jordan. And if you'd like to ask our guest a question, you can email it to radioplanetwatch@gmail.com. And I suppose if any of our guests wanted to walk to the microphone and ask a question, they could also do that, since we have that capacity to turn on their mics.
Oh, that's a new one. Yeah, that would be fun and exciting. Next best thing to a call-in. But I got another comment/question for you here, Catherine, and everybody. You know, I'm looking for the word poverty in your book. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm sure it's in there. And of course, overpopulation is very inextricably intertwined with poverty. And most people, it's obvious the connection from overpopulation to poverty. You got too many people to feed, too many mouths to feed, you know, you're in poverty. But an even more connection goes the other way, and very few people realize this. The causal connection from poverty to overpopulation. In other words, if you are poor, which is the way women and families are when there's not enough education and you don't have enough of a breadwinning background. If you are poor, there are a whole host of reasons why you then overpopulate the world. So that connection is very interesting. And I'm wondering if your book, sneak preview, is that in your book? Or do you talk about poverty? Or how does that rank in all this?
I really appreciate that question. So there are, I think, a number of themes that are cross-cutting through the book. So poverty is not one of the, kind of addressing poverty is not one of the 100 solutions as called out unto itself. But we try to tease out throughout the content of the book, not just what's the impact of X solution on carbon emissions, but what are those cascading benefits that it has for society and in many cases for economic development and for raising quality of life, right? So you can think about distributed energy is hugely important from that perspective, and of course also has important public health implications as well, moving away from kerosene and diesel generators. And at the same time, what we try to do is address the, what we call the yeah buts of the solution. So what are the, what are the potential downsides? What are the ways in which it needs to be implemented or not implemented? What are any sort of potential risks, these sorts of things. So we really try to bring a broad perspective in both ways, but you'll certainly see some attention to kind of broader issues of social justice that cut through the book.
And I did want to mention we are speaking with Catherine Wilkinson. She is senior writer at Project Drawdown, which is Paul Hawkins' new project and book by the same name about 100 solutions to carbon emissions and global warming. And I bet people cannot guess what the top one is. Anybody want a hazard in this room? Take a guess, wild guess?
Nope.
Taking a wild guess?
I want to say it's to eat a plant-based diet, but I'm not sure. I just want to say that because I'm a vegetarian.
You want to say that. Okay, is he right? What do you think, Catherine?
I am also a vegetarian and would have loved for that to be number one. It's number four, plant-rich diet.
It's still up there.
And certainly, if we were to have calculated adoption of a vegetarian diet worldwide, it might have been higher. But number one is sort of just profoundly unsexy. It's focused on management of refrigerant chemicals. So as folks will know, the 1987 Montreal Protocol phased out the use of ozone-destroying refrigerants, and their primary replacement chemical, HFCs, have almost no bad impact on the ozone layer, but they are 1,000 or times more powerful than carbon dioxide in terms of their greenhouse effect. So solved one problem, created another. And as folks may also know, back in October of last year, we were, I think, all a little bit distracted with an impending election, but officials from around the world gathered in Kigali, Rwanda, and came to an agreement to actually amend the Montreal Protocol to require a phase-out of HFCs over the coming decades. And scientists think that agreement alone will reduce global warming by about half a degree Celsius. But, of course, until we get to that phase out, and even when we do get there, there are all of these HFCs already in circulation in our air conditioning units and refrigerators and cold chains, and there will be more HFCs in circulation. So what's counted here in the number, the impact is almost 90 gigatons by 2050, is looking at actually sort of proper management and disposal of those HFCs. So in particular, the point of disposal is when about 90% of emissions occur. So if you can get that right, you can end up having quite a big impact.
Yeah, those HFCs, I'm not sure if Catherine said it, but that stands for hydrofluorocarbons. You've heard of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs. Those are what got banned and are largely no longer used in the world those had a tremendous impact, not only on the greenhouse effect and global warming, but also on destroying the Earth's ozone layer. I was directly involved in a lot of the research that led to that Montreal Protocol in 1987 at NASA. And sometime we can talk more about that on this radio show. But look, one of our people in the audience here, in the live in-studio audience, Michael McKay, the aforementioned, has a question that he actually sent me last night, and I promised him I'd get it on here, which is, what about the time factor in all this? These are all obviously very important, good things to be doing, but is there time? You know, are we going to turn things around? Are we going to reverse climate change? Are we going to fix the climate really in time to make any difference? Well, say the next 2-3 generations, hopefully at least farther down the line, will help heal things. But what's your sense of the urgency and the realistic realism of hoping that we can actually do any of this in time?
Yeah, it's an important question. So I will also, by way of answering this question, throw in a definition, which we haven't talked about yet, which is that we use the term drawdown to refer to the point in time at which the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere will, we hope, peak and then begin to decline on a year-to-year basis. So that's the kind of big goal that this project puts forward, right? Not to slow emissions or even stop emissions or stabilize concentrations at a particular level, but actually hit this turning point of heading back to conditions that are most conducive for life. And what you'll see if you pick up the book is that we actually have three scenarios of analysis that are there, and the main one we call the plausible scenario, largely because we wanted to, you know, to put forth numbers that people wouldn't say, well, yeah, I mean, technically, maybe. No, actually, we've been pretty conservative in the assumptions behind this analysis. So the numbers that you see as you turn the pages, we think are very doable. Certainly, we have the technical capacity to get to drawdown. In the plausible scenario, we don't actually hit that point of drawdown by 2050, but there are two other scenarios in the back of the book which kind of optimize, and one of them is actually the drawdown scenario. So sort of how quickly can we get there and what would need to be delivered from these different solutions. So I think the good news is that we have the solutions in hand. We have the technical capability, and that doesn't even begin to look at 20 other solutions that we include in the back of the book that we call coming attractions, which don't have the same body of data and peer-reviewed research behind them because they are nascent or perhaps still in development, but we're also likely to get some help from those over the next 30 years as well. So it still, of course, relies on people, you know, kind of taking up the work. But our sense is that people are actually hungry to do that. And what we've been missing is kind of a clear game plan.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is Sunday, so a little teensy weensy micro sermon here for all of our listeners. A saying that I am fond of because it's so true is where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, so we got lots of ways here. You know, I say let 1,000 flowers bloom. Well, your book is saying, and let's let at least 100 of them bloom. But look, getting the will there on the part of, you know, the American people, and in particular our so-called leaders, many of whom have their heads buried in the sands of Saudi Arabia, you know, for instance. So
is that where they're buried?
Yes. Well, anyway, getting the will out there, which depends on education and the magic communications of the wonders of media. So that's what we're about here. That's why we're doing this.
Catherine, we're going to take a very short commercial break, pause break, and we'll be right back to talk with Catherine Wilkinson of Project Drawdown about 100 ways you can save the planet. We'll be right back right here on Planet Watch.
I'm Matt Thompson, Santa Cruz resident and project manager for Day One Solar. I find Santa Cruz to be such a unique place. You have community-minded residents that really appreciate the beauty that surrounds us. But with that comes a responsibility to protect our natural resources for generations to come. At Day One Solar, we offer clean energy systems that will save you money while you help save our planet. Solar energy now. Day One Solar.
Healthcare that fits your Santa Cruz lifestyle. That's why Dignity Health Dominican Hospital and Dignity Health Medical Group Dominican work with you to make personal choices regarding your health. It's the type of care we can offer because we're more than just a hospital and medical group. We're part of this community. Visit DominicanHospital.org to find a doctor and start living healthy today. Healthcare that fits your Santa Cruz lifestyle. Dignity Health. Hello, human kindness.
And you're listening to Planet Watch. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman, along with Joe Jordan, and we're speaking with Catherine Wilkinson. She is a senior writer at Project Drawdown. Project Drawdown is a project of Paul Hawken, the best-selling author and entrepreneur who also started Smith & Hawken Tools and a number of other things. He also wrote the book Natural Capitalism, which did bring him in for some praise, lots of praise, and some criticism from some critics who said it was too much market-based focused and did not rely enough on simplification and ramping down some of our obsession with technology.
And just a note, there was an earlier book that he wrote, which had a very intriguing and important title, The Ecology of Commerce. And that brings in one of my other favorite sayings, is that the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. You know, there's all these financial people, and, you know, they think the economy is the be-all and end-all. Well, hey, you ain't got nature, you ain't got an economy. Everybody needs to get that straight.
Well, let's ask that question then, since I think it was Eric Utney who... there's some interesting publication connections between Paul Hawken and Eric Utney. He runs the Utney Reader,
yeah.
And I believe Paul Hawken was involved with the original Whole Earth Review, Whole Earth Catalog. Nonetheless, Catherine, I'm curious about your point of view about whether you think capitalism is inherently at odds with solving the environmental crisis, or is it just going to be that the market will solve this? I know that's a loaded question.
Yes. Well, I'm going to use all the time the wholly owned subsidiary quote. I think that's really fantastic. So I think you can make arguments in both directions. I think what is really helpful here is that I think capitalism will actually help us to scale these solutions, and that's because almost all of them pencil out, which is to say, you know, that there's a real economic upside for them. And what we show is that, of course, there is a cost to implement in most cases, not all, however, but that the world could look at realizing a savings of almost $75 trillion by 2050. So the economic opportunity that comes sort of very clearly through this analysis is strong, and I think, you know, we're already seeing businesses look at these solutions as business opportunities. We're even starting to see companies like Interface, whose entire sustainability journey actually was inspired by the Ecology of Commerce, looking at taking on drawdown, what they call climate take back, at pulling carbon back down out of the atmosphere, as also a business opportunity. So I think that we'll have that working for us.
Yeah, and I have a question. So we ended up the discussion before the commercial break talking about America and how we can get people active to help fight climate change. And I think one of the major flaws is that people only look at what the effects are in their own country. But like you said, America is one of the biggest emitters of, you know, carbon dioxide and CO2. But through the research that I was doing, I found that the countries that have the lowest emissions are going to get hit harder. And what do you know exactly how much more severe in a country, say India, is going to get affected by climate change as opposed to the United States?
So I agree with you in kind of broad brushstrokes. The places most responsible for causing the problem are not going to bear the greatest brunt of it, although I don't think any of us will be spared, frankly. And I think it's really important to have that perspective about negative impacts if the problem's left unchecked. I also think the perspective of, coming in looking through the lens of solutions also lets us do sort of the flip side of the coin, which is what are the positive impacts of pursuing the solutions to reversing global warming? And I think in that sense, you do see a lot of very local benefit in terms of job creation, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that what we've really been missing oftentimes in the climate space is enough heft, both in terms of research and in terms of discourse around solutions, to stand side by side with the incredible weight of the problem and the incredible body of work that's been done on that side.
Really good answer and interesting perspective. I do have a question from a listener, and we want to bring them into the conversation. They have written us at radioplanetwatch@gmail.com. So,
like you can, too. John, who in, Pacific Grove, California, happens to be a world-class oceanographer and marine biologist. And he says, please ask the interviewee about the possibilities of pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere, particularly the ocean. In nature, that's a slow process, so we have to have ways to speed it up. The processes he has seen just pulled out of the atmosphere as CO2, which then might be used to enhance greenhouse plant production or stored underground. He says, but this is not net removal unless it is turned into peat or coal. And then he says, and the second is risky at best. I'm not sure. Anyway,
but here's
the main thing. In the last line, the bottom line. In the ocean, biomineralization producing carbonates is just too slow by itself. So
speeding up nature. Can you do it?
One of the, I mentioned we have this section on coming attractions in the book, 20 solutions. Certainly there could have been many more coming attractions in the book, but one of them is marine permaculture. So it is actually focused on how do you both bring kind of primary productivity back to sections of the ocean where it's been lost and speed it up. So essentially, how do you foster giant kelp forests that are super effective at sequestering carbon dioxide through photosynthesis, and then also end up, feeding animal life, et cetera, et cetera. So that is absolutely one of the areas that, again, not enough research there to make the same kind of projections we did for the 80 solutions that are, maybe you could call them trains that have already left the station. but this one certainly seems very promising.
And Catherine, one of the ones at the top of the list people might not think of as well are reduced food waste and solar farms. Let's talk about those because those are in the top 10, meaning it's above 30, 40 or 50 gigatons of carbon removal. Tell us a little bit more about reducing food waste. How does that remove carbon?
Absolutely. I'll say by way of context, it's really interesting. The food sector is 8 out of the top 20. Energy is 5 out of the top 20. And the food sector is the largest emissions reduction of any of them. So there's something interesting there, I think, in terms of the way that we think about solving climate change, which has so often been focused on our sources and use of energy, which is clearly a very big piece of the puzzle, but not the whole thing. And as you mentioned, Rachel, reduced food waste is it's number 3 of 80. And what we've looked at here is that a third of the food we produce around the world is not consumed. It's about 40%, I think, in the U.S. Folks who are listening, if you've never done it, Google photos of food waste and you will be sure to be horrified. that waste drives about 8% of our annual greenhouse gas emissions. So if you ranked food waste as a country, it would come in third behind China and the U.S. The drivers of food waste are different in high and low income countries, and that has something to do also with the impact of food waste. So where income is low and infrastructure is weak, wastage tends to occur earlier in the supply chain. So food rots on farms because there's not good access to a market or labor, or it spoils during storage or distribution. And then in regions of higher income like ours, we tend to waste by choice. So it happens at the other end of the supply chain. Retailers and consumers are picky. We overbuy. We refuse ugly apples. Forget about, you know, leftover lasagna in the fridge. And particularly in places where you have food traveling a long ways through the supply chain, you're just squandering a host of resources at every stage: seeds, water, energy, land, fertilizer, labor, capital. And at each of those stages, there are greenhouse gases getting generated, including, of course, methane if you've got decomposing or organic matter that's, you know, not being composted or dealt with in a digester. So, and then add on to that, you may then also have cause for more deforestation, for additional farmland to make more food that we don't eat. So because you've got so many dynamics at work and sources of emissions at work around food waste, that's part of why it ends up being so significant.
And we're describing a problem, but you really are focused on solutions. So what is the solution to that? Just eat local and don't throw away your food. Eat everything on your plate if you're in a developed country, and if you're not, we need to get this food to market. Is it that simple? Probably not.
Sure. So this is one, you know, and I think you can think about plant-rich diets similarly. It's very easy to say don't waste food, you know, eat more plants and less meat. There are, I think, more sort of systemic ways in to address the problem. So there are countries like France that have simply said, look, grocery stores, you cannot throw away food. You have to find other avenues for it to be used, whether for human consumption or some other useful application. Date labeling is a big thing. So the Best Buy, Used By, et cetera, dates that are on most of our food products are by and large unregulated, and it causes a lot of confusion that, you know, is this thing now bad? Should I throw this thing away? And the reality is that they are, for the most part, not focused on safety. So again, a kind of clear regulation and standardization around those could really have an impact.
Well, it sounded like you were on a roll. You got one more thought there?
Well, I was going to say, and then, you know, sort of more more kind of cultural practices, right, around things like there's a group called Feeding the 5,000 that puts on these large feasts, all made from nearly wasted food, to kind of raise awareness about this issue as well.
A rotten food party. I'm going.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I may have missed something because I was momentarily distracted. We have emails coming in, which is good. But I guess the direct mechanism by which rotting food can emit greenhouse gases is simply the biochemistry of rotting food. You got carbon stored in the food, and now it gets returned to the atmosphere. But another way is, a big one, is that, look, if you waste a third of the food produced on the planet for all these 7+ billion people, that means you got to make even more food than you really had to get everybody fed. And, of course, the process of making food and growing plants and trucking stuff all around, that's a greenhouse gas intensive process. So, yeah. But we got a response from our expert oceanographer folks here, and I'm just going to, we'll continue the debate later, but just FYI, the problem with kelp forests is they are consumed and recycled quickly and turned back to CO2, so they do not give a net removal of CO2 from the hydrosphere. And that's John and Vicky Pierce, who used to teach marine biology up here at UC Santa Cruz, and they're now down in the Monterey area.
And thank Catherine, you, I imagine you're getting some feedback from scientists all over the world, and that's the yes but question you mentioned, which is, you know, there's a lot more debate and fine-tuning of any of these solutions. I'm sure that's going to need to be done to make them all actually viable. Some of them are already underway, as you said, and others are still under debate about how exactly it's going to work.
And, hey, probably, Catherine, we should ask this privately, but what the heck, I'm going to throw it out here publicly. You know, there is a TED Radio Hour. There is a Bioneers Radio Project. I don't think there is a Project Drawdown Radio Project yet. You know what? You and us should talk, and Paul Hawken, real soon about, you know, getting this going. Because, I mean, hey, 100 projects at least? We can spend the rest of our lives doing good stuff, getting the word out there. So I'm serious. I mean, I'm serious. Get a hold of Paul, and let's have a little powwow here and get this figured out. Okay.
That sounds great. And I'll throw in, you've mentioned, feedback from scientists. I think it's really important for people to know also that Project Drawdown is very much it's sort of a community project. It's a coalition. We have a huge 130-plus board of advisors who have been very involved in the work in various ways. In the case of marine permaculture, we worked very closely with Brian von Herzen, who is doing some really fascinating work around these marine permaculture arrays. And as I understand from Brian, the phytoplankton and the kelp that does not get consumed dies off, and the majority of it drops into the deep sea. So it actually does sequester carbon in the form of dissolved carbon and carbonates for potentially centuries. So I am not a marine scientist, but I'll throw that in on Brian's behalf.
Great. But you play one on the radio. We only have a minute or so left of this interview, but I wanted to ask you, and this might be for the audience as well, you know, people spend a lot of time and energy and focus on some things they think are making a huge difference. Now you've done this research, it kind of shows what does and doesn't yield the most result in terms of carbon reduction. Retrofitting houses, I would have thought, was way at the top. It's number 80. Net zero buildings is 79. It doesn't mean they don't do much, but you said it's negligible, the actual carbon impact. Why are those things at the bottom?
Yeah. So there's a whole section on buildings and cities, and many of those things are focused on efficiency, right? So so reducing energy use, but not eliminating it, or not completely displacing a more polluting technology. So partially that's why they sit there. Those two in particular, retrofitting and net zero buildings, it was really important in this work that we address any potential for double counting. So you'll see we also have solutions around more efficient insulation, smart windows, LED lighting, heat pumps, et cetera, smart thermostats, building automation. So many of these things that you might put into a retrofitted building or a net zero building, the impact is already counted somewhere else.
Right.
And you'll see a similar thing on energy. Energy storage and grid flexibility don't have any impact tied to them, and that's because they're really critical enablers of renewable energy sources. So the impact is counted somewhere else.
Not only things need done, but just they don't calculate with this ranking. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, Catherine, for being with us here on Planet Watch. Thank you for being our guest. It's been a wonderful discussion, and I hope people will read the book Drawdown by Paul Hawken. Thanks so much for being here.
Mo better later, as I always say.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Catherine. Look forward to meeting you sometime.
All right.
Likewise.
And this is Planet Watch, and we appreciate you tuning in this afternoon. We're just about out of time.
Yeah, we've got half a minute left for my sky phenomenon.
That's
look, folks,
30 seconds.
The whole western United States, especially California, can tonight see the International Space Station go almost overhead. It's going to be still a little bit light out, but at 9:03 p.m., look to the northwest. You will see a bright light coming straight up out of the northwest. It's going to pass just shy of overhead, and then it will go down in the southeast. It'll take 6 minutes to go all the way across the sky.
Thank you, Joe Jordan.
So 9:03 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Bye-bye. Keep an eye on the sky.
This is Planet Watch. Thank you for listening. It's produced at KSCO AM 1080. Special thanks to our engineer, Jason, and our interns, Tommy Martin, Cade Pastelnik, and Caroline King. Special thanks to Eugene Beer and Columbus, Ohio, for running our program there. For more information, go to our Facebook page, Radio Planet Watch, or that is Planet Watch Radio. And thanks so much for listening.